Hi, ActiveHistory.ca is happy to feature a recording of Erica Lee's lecture, Local, National, and Transnational Histories of Immigration to the Americas. In this talk, she uses examples from her own fascinating research to explore the question, how can historians integrate local, national, and transnational frames of reference to better understand the history of immigration? The talk was given on October 19th, 2012, as part of the Borderlands Workshop at Glendon College in Toronto.
Thanks so much. I'm really happy to be here. It feels like a reunion of friends. And I know that we're all learning a lot. Our conversations this morning were a lot of fun. I know that those of us at Minnesota, there's five of us, we're really happy to be here. I think I was just thinking about it, that we all heard about the conference and got Ben and Alex's invitation all at the same time. I think we were in seminar, Andrew and Evan and I, and we were just like, guess what? I got an invitation. Me too. So we're happy that this long-awaited conference has come to fruition. I'm going to start with a couple of research stories that hopefully will help us think about these issues. And I know that we're all thinking about these from various different angles. I hope that these are helpful in your own thinking. I assume that the more interesting part will be when we talk about these together. So I hope that these comments will help us have a larger conversation. So the first story starts in graduate school. It was my second year, and I was having one of those panic moments that I think that many of us have when we're starting out a project, but especially when things are so new. I was researching my dissertation, which was a study of Chinese immigration during the Chinese exclusion era in the United States. And I think I had just come back from one of my many research trips to the National Archives. We have regional branches in the United States, and I was doing most of my work in the San Francisco Bay Area, so this was the regional branch in San Bruno, California. I was one of the first researchers to be able to get access to what were some records that had just been recently opened up by the U.S. government. And these were thousands, tens of thousands of immigrant records for the Port of San Francisco that documented everything from arrivals, departures, physical exams, interrogations, work histories, family relationships. So I'd be looking through these files and I'd find things like my grandparents' wedding photograph or some guy's wallet that had literally been confiscated in a workplace raid. So they ranged in just in wondrous detail. And there were between 60 and 100,000 of them. They were so new that the boxes had literally not been unsealed, the folders had not been put into Mylar. And the archivists didn't even know, how many records there were. So I had gone from one of those moments when you're a graduate student to thinking, what am I going to write on? I won't be able to find anything, to literally, how will I ever get through these records and how do I make sense of them? And of course, I didn't plan on looking through every single record, but I quickly just became immersed in these details. And so this research panic moment came when I was at that time where I knew where these records were leading me, but I was having trouble picturing how to tell this larger story. What was the forest for the trees? So I sat in my advisor's office explaining this predicament, and he told me to think about the immigration station of Angel Island, which is the Ellis Island of the West. This is the processing center, detention center for most immigrants who enter the United States through the Port of San Francisco. Most of them are Asian. But he told me to think about Angel Island as a lens. So it's sure, be interested in these details, these fascinating threads, but then lift your head up and think about Angel Island as a lens that reflected broader social, economic, political trends in U.S. history. And this way of framing, this lens metaphor, has really shaped my historical research since then, And as many of my students here can confirm, I repeat this to every one of them struggling with the same questions. I've since expanded on this metaphor to better understand shifting scales of immigration. So when I was writing the dissertation, it was very much of a social, legal history of Chinese immigration, and it was looking at community history and making it relevant for the nation. So community, local, and then nation. It's been particularly helpful to me in considering these different lenses, local, community, national, transnational, that so many of us are engaged in. But I've expanded this a little bit. So we were talking earlier today in my group, the way that I think of this lens is multiple. It could be a magnifying glass or a telescope that lets us zoom in on those minute details and fine texture. But it could also be a telescope or panoramic lens that enables us to see remotely how a particular site or event, person, process connects across space and national borders. The lens that I find most useful is a kaleidoscope. It's a continually shifting one where whatever the vantage point you have, the pictures change, the colors change, the patterns change, and allows us to think about processes in multiple intersecting patterns. Randy had an added suggestion today in our section. It's a satellite lens that, you know, even farther away, that allows you to look at the entire world in one scope, that then allows you to zoom in with laser point accuracy on this particular site. So I like that as well. So I'd like to apply this framework and expand upon it to ask the question, when is immigration history local community history? When is it national history? When is it borderlands, hemispheric, international, transnational, diasporic, or global history? So just at lunchtime, we were talking, I joined a conversation late in the game about how exactly do we define things? What terms would we use? And I said, I've just given up, and I've thrown up my hands because it's gotten difficult. The field of transnational studies has matured enough that I feel like we, at the beginning, there was a very precise definition of transnationalism. It was rooted in anthropology. It looked about immigrant sending and immigrant receiving networks. And then it became so diffuse, everyone was doing transnationalism. We've tried to rein that back in to talk about, you know, very specific definitions. And we're at this in-between stage where we've gone through these various cycles of adjustment that we can think anew about the validity of these concepts and how to apply them. So I'm advocating for a very flexible framework. Let me draw on some previous work that helps me articulate this process. So this first research, the dissertation, and then later the first book, primarily shifted between the local community and national lenses. Some of the research I developed for the book, this is the At America's Gates book, centered on the extension of Chinese exclusion policies to the U.S.-Canadian and U.S.-Mexican borders. This was amongst the first to look at both borders in relationship to each other. And so many people in this room have helped me along the way, and it's become a much more vibrant field. That segue into the borderlands helped me think about becoming more of a borderlands scholar. People like Elliot and Grace helped me think through that. But more recently, I've transitioned from a U.S. in the world perspective to a hemispheric American perspective, and more formally now to world history. So my current approach to immigration history mirrors this. My answer to the question, is immigration history local, community, national, international, or transnational, global, is simply yes, all of the above. Let me first draw on the history of Angel Island to explore these questions more. This is a map of the immigrant routes that came through San Francisco. From 1910 to 1940, San Francisco and the Angel Island Immigration Station served as the entry point for over 500,000 people from 80 different countries around the world. Two-thirds came from China and Japan, but there were also immigrants from India, Korea, Russia, Mexico, the Philippines, Germany, Spain, Central and South America, Australia, and New Zealand. The Angel Island Immigration Station was called in the press and by the U.S. government, quote unquote, the Ellis Island of the West, but in fact was very different from its counterpart in New York. Ellis Island enforced American immigration laws that restricted but never excluded European immigrants, at least on the basis of race. Angel Island, on the other hand, was the chief point of entry for Chinese and other immigrants from Asia, and as such, enforced immigration policies designed to single out Asians for long detention and exclusion. In 2005, historian Judy Young, who is emeritus at UC Santa Cruz, and I started to write the first comprehensive history of immigration through Angel Island. It was published in 2010, and it was published to coincide with the immigration station centennial, so it's 100th year anniversary of the opening. And it sought to tell the history of the great diverse immigration through America's Pacific Gateway, with its emphasis on the immigration station itself, the surrounding area, the immigrant communities that would end up primarily in the state of California or elsewhere in the US West. Our book resonated regionally. It was seen as a Western book. It was honored by the San Francisco Chronicle and the Western History Association. But our intention was to reach a national audience as well. We sought to use Angel Island as a microcosm for larger national trends and issues. We explicitly compare, for example, Angel Island with Ellis Island, and that strong nation of immigrants mythos that pervades Ellis Island and its related Statue of Liberty. The nation of immigrants narrative focuses primarily on European peasant migrant families who entered through New York, eventually became absorbed into that great melting pot of America. The story is that the United States welcomed them, and in return, these immigrants worked hard, assimilated, and became productive citizens. In building our national frame, we posited that Angel Island helps us answer or complicates this question. Is the United States, or has it ever been, that nation of immigrants that this mythology supports? Or is it something different, a gatekeeping nation that builds fences and detention centers to keep out aliens it defines as undesirable and dangerous? And we argue that Angel Island says that the United States is both. And it's this tension between this welcome and restriction that is increasingly important in contemporary times. So the local and national frames of Angel Island's immigration history were explicitly clear in our book, but what about the transnational and global side to the story? As an immigration history, there is, of course, much non-US content in the book, but because the purpose of the book as community-engaged scholarship, really drawn from in partnerships with local communities, that was simultaneously trying to foster a common multi-ethnic and interracial consciousness about the history of Angel Island. We did not emphasize the transnational or global perspectives explicitly. If we did, it was through the perspective of global migrants being pitted against a new gatekeeping apparatus of the United States. This was the right approach for the book and for the purpose of that book and the partnerships with communities that we had. But today, I'd like to retell some chapters to examine the global web in which these seemingly local and national incidents occurred, and then to think about how we make these choices of scale. So chapter one is called Angel Island, from local history to U.S. history to Asian history and the global history of anti-colonialism in the early 20th century. Let me start with the local. Shortly after the Angel Island Immigration Station opened in January 1910, San Francisco Commissioner of Immigration, Hart Hyatt North, found himself at the center of a political firestorm. The San Francisco-based Asiatic Exclusion League was furious at what they believed was North's lack of vigilance in excluding South Asian immigrants. A shocking increase in the number of arrivals from San Francisco, place the San Francisco media, Angel Island immigration officials, and local organizations on high alert. Hart Hyatt North seemed unfazed. This is a picture of him in the administration building of the Angel Island immigration station. He treated South Asians like any other immigrant group and processed them under the general immigration laws. This attitude was at odds with exclusion activists and other Angel Island inspectors who believed that the government should actively restrict their immigration whenever possible. For anti-Asian activists, the quote-unquote likely to become a public charge clause provided a convenient cover for racial exclusion. Typical was the articulation of South Asian immigrants as undesirable citizens in multiple ways for their race, class, religion, and gender, and threat, economic threat, as expressed in this cartoon from the Daily News, June 28, 1910. But also of the published sentiments of immigrant inspectors like Frank Ainsworth, who explained that, quote, these Hindus are highly unassimilable. Ainsworth advocated an official immigration policy of exclusion, but his superior, Commissioner North, rejected this position. South Asians might not be desirable citizens, he conceded, but, quote, no government official has a right to refuse entrance to this country to any man entitled under the law to land, end quote. If South Asians were to be legally excluded, then the United States needed to pass a general Asian exclusion law, the commissioner argued. So at this point, this conflict is really local. It's even within the offices of the Angel Island Immigration Station, or more publicly aired within the local press. It involves a San Francisco organization, the Asiatic Exclusion League, San Francisco-based immigration officials, and politicians like Hart Hyatt North. But it quickly turns into a federal matter. With the full support of the San Francisco press, the Asiatic Exclusion League initiated a campaign to remove North from office. It nicknamed the commissioner Sahib North, and local newspapers argued that, quote, a horde of Hindus here are here to enjoy the welcome extended by Hart North. The campaign went to Washington, D.C. North's subordinates at Angel Island complained to the Commissioner General of Immigration. Exclusion leaders also wrote to D.C. and argued that North was, quote, not in harmony with public sentiment in California, nor is he enforcing the law without fear or favor, end quote. So notice here that the primary rationale for this campaign against North is local, the sentiment here. The League canvassed the cities and communities throughout the Bay Area and gathered 1,800 signatures calling for North's removal. In October, he was fired and suspended from his duties. This local episode turned into a national issue and resulted in a change of leadership in San Francisco ordered by the INS in Washington. The consequences of these actions would have an even greater effect on the global level. After North's departure, immigration officials on Angel Island acted quickly to institute a system of informal South Asian exclusion. This is before the passage of the 1917 Asiatic Bar Zone, which excluded South Asians by law. So, for example, in September, while North was in office, immigration officials debarred or excluded 46% of all South Asian applicants for admission. The next month, while North was fighting for his career, immigration officials denied entry to 181 out of 184 South Asian applicants, or 98%. By December, none of the South Asian applicants were admitted, and in April of 1911, the Asiatic Exclusion League reported satisfactorily that only 11 South Asians had been admitted into the United States in San Francisco in the past 5 months. The aggressive tactics of exclusion by Angel Island officials contributed to a growing sense of frustration and injustice on the part of the South Asian diaspora. Coupled with similar attempts in Canada to limit or bar South Asian immigrants through its continuous journey law, the Angel Island policies reflected widespread discrimination against South Asians in North America. Indian nationalists, many of them students at UC Berkeley, organized the Gutter Party Revolution, or Mutiny is the translation, with headquarters in San Francisco, pictured here. And they preached a message protesting against both discrimination in the U.S. and Canada and British colonialism in India. Gutterites circulated throughout immigrant communities in the Americas, Europe, and East and Southeast Asia with the goal of rallying the local South Asian communities to the cause of Indian independence and to define a positive collective identity amongst immigrants as nationalists. After World War I broke out, the Gutter Party urged all nationalists to return to India to work towards the overthrow of the British. Thousands of immigrants turned revolutionaries returned to India carrying their own weapons and ready for armed revolt. The largest group of 60 men left San Francisco on the steamship Korea on August 29, 1914. On board was a student turned Gutter leader named Kartar Singh. He had studied electrical engineering at Berkeley before devoting his time full-time to the anti-colonial movement. The boat reached Calcutta in November of 1914. An uprising was planned for February 21st, 1915, but before the nationalists could carry out their plans, Kartar Singh and others were arrested by government authorities and tried for their role in the planned revolt. A series of three conspiracy trials took place in Lahore in 1915. Hundreds of individuals were sentenced to death, given life prison sentences, or sent to prison for shorter terms. Kartar Singh, as one of the leaders, was sentenced to death and executed at the age of 18. By 1915, then, the seemingly local dispute between anti-Asian activists in San Francisco and Commissioner of Immigration Hart Hyatt North on Angel Island could be tied to a larger global landscape of anti-colonial activities halfway across the world. I'm not necessarily suggesting that the sacking of North in 1910 directly led to the Lahore trials of 1915, but rather that when we use different lenses simultaneously and zoom in and out to see both local factors and global connections, we can get much larger and much more complicated understanding of the past. People have written about Hart Hyatt North before. It's often within the context of a local history of Asian exclusion in California. People have written about the Lahore conspiracy trials, but it's mostly within the context of a larger history of the anti-colonial movement in India. And I'm thinking about how do we connect these stories together. The second chapter of this talk is called Angel Island as European History to World and U.S. History to Community and Family History. So kind of going back down. This story starts in Nazi Germany. In 1938, after Germany invaded Austria and Czechoslovakia and turned to state-sanctioned pogroms to drive the Jews out of the country, 140,000 German and Austrian Jews fled their homelands to find refuge in Western Europe, China, and abroad. An estimated 24,000 took the eastward route by sea from Italy to Shanghai, where no visas were required for entry. This is the Chinese Schindler, if you've remembered that, or by land across Siberia to Harbin and Japan. From there, some 3,000 refugees crossed the Pacific and reached their final destinations in the United States, Canada, Australia, and Palestine, while the remaining 21,000 stayed in Shanghai until the end of the war. At least 500 Jewish refugees made it to San Francisco from Shanghai and Yokohama in 1939 and 1940. Among them was a woman named Elfried Alice Edelstein and her mother, Hilda. This is Alice. Born in Vienna, Austria, the only child in a middle-class Jewish family, Alice Edelstein had led a comfortable life until the Nazis had annexed Austria in 1938. Then began the pogroms, the mass arrests, confinement into ghettos, confiscation of Jewish properties and businesses, and the barring of Jews from public, professional practice and public service. Close to 100,000 Jews fled Austria by the end of 1939, including Alice's father, Marcel. He had just enough money to get one visa to Santo Domingo in the Dominican Republic. But before he left, Marcel looked up every Edelstein in the U.S. phone books, seeking a family to sponsor his wife and daughter. He found one in Milwaukee who agreed to help. This was the only way that you could come into the country during this time if you were fleeing Nazi-occupied Europe. By the time Hilda and Alice secured their visas and were ready to leave in July of 1940, Italy had entered the war and the Mediterranean Sea route was closed to them. They decided to escape by land and to the Pacific. So they took a Trans-Siberian railway from Moscow to Vladivostok with only $6 in cash and a limited amount of luggage. The train ride took close to 4 weeks. From Vladivostok, they took a ship to Kobe, and then the Rikuyu-Maru across the Pacific to San Francisco. This is a photograph of the 500 refugees arriving in San Francisco, September of 1940. This is a ship that held 100 refugees. They joined 100 other Jewish refugees from Nazi Germany on the Rikuyu-Maru, which brought them to San Francisco. Because they had no money to pay for their train tickets to get to Milwaukee, Alice and Hilda were detained at the immigration station on Angel Island for 3 days until their sponsor sent funds to them. They were quickly admitted and then went on to Milwaukee. Alice Edelstein's Angel Island story resumed in the years we were researching our book. Judy Young was able to interview Alice and record her immigration experience in the chapter we wrote about Russian immigrants. This research helped jumpstart the Angel Island Immigration Station Foundation's research efforts to investigate the histories of the diverse immigrants on Angel Island. The foundation is the nonprofit body that is responsible for the preservation of public history of Angel Island. This is a nonprofit organization very much rooted in community engagement. In preparation for the immigration station centennial in 2010, the foundation began to collect what they called immigrant voices, a community-driven effort to contribute to the nation's immigration history. The foundation also wanted to use the Immigrant Voices Project to expand its constituency and its profile beyond the Chinese American community. Executive Director Eddie Wong located another Rikuyu-Maru passenger and interviewed the then 89-year-old Ava Schott. The way in which they found Ava Schott was when we were actually promoting the book, we were doing some radio interviews, and we got this call in from Ava Schott, who said, I came through Angel Island as part of, this is not what she sounded like, but she said she had arrived on Angel Island, but she was one of the Jewish refugees, and we were able to then connect back with her. So this is like how books have after histories. It's wonderful. Ava Schott recalled the escape from Nazi Germany, the long trip to Moscow across the Soviet Union, the boat to Harbin, China, and then to Yokohama. Aboard the Rikuyu-Maru, she took photographs. One of them shows her and Alice Edelstein together with a few other young women. So these are all things that that we've learned after the book was published. But Alice is far left and Ava is far right. This is a photograph of the Angel Island's community immigrant voices efforts available online, and this is Ava's story. The discovery of Ava Schott yielded another great find, the only existing diary kept by a Rikuyu-Maru passenger that vividly described the conditions on the ship. The foundation shared all of these findings with Alice Edelstein's daughter, Nora Steiner Mealy, who discussed these new documents to an Angel Island audience this past summer. As her family looked on, she described how these pieces of history fit together to create a fuller portrait of her now deceased mother and her experiences during the war. A lot of questions that the family had were now answered with these other historical sources. So a world history event had turned into a community organized driven research project and helped to revise the history of immigration on Angel Island, but also the family history of the Steiners. So again, going from this scale all the way back down. Photographs of immigrants arriving on Angel Island and the Angel Island immigration station. So let me turn to another evolution from transnational and global immigration history to local and then back again. And when I get through with this, then I think you'll understand why I've kind of thrown up my hands at trying to choose a scale. This story also begins in the archives when I was a graduate student. Never throw anything out, I think, is the answer. Those initial research trips, you may not be focusing it on right now, but it'll come back. At the same time that I sifted through those immigration files, I was in D.C. and I came across a box titled, quote, Oriental Problem, Other Countries. In letters and government reports, I noticed that U.S. immigration officials kept referring to Asian immigrants, especially Chinese, Japanese, and South Asians, and the so-called Oriental Problem in Canada, Mexico, Australia, Peru, Brazil, South Africa, and other countries around the world. Some of these files were extremely thick, filled with correspondence between U.S. officials and their counterparts in other countries. They also included records of covert U.S. investigations conducted abroad. Government officials, diplomats, labor leaders, and journalists all seemed to be asking the same question. How could the Asian immigration problem be solved? What could be learned from the experiences of other countries? I had, of course, known that Asian immigrants in other countries faced immigration restriction and discrimination similar to that of the United States, but I had never read anything that suggested that these campaigns might be linked in some way. So 10 years ago, before the Angel Island book, I set out to write a book that examined the transnational debates and immigration policies concerning Asian immigration in the Americas, and the starting point was, I thought, late 19th century to the end of World War II. As a U.S. historian, so this is really, now I'm showing my age, but this is when the word transnational was really just becoming part of the U.S. history lexicon. There was that 1998 Journal of American History special issue that kind of introduced what is transnational history to U.S. history. And so we were all trying to figure out, how do you do this exactly? And I thought that the first way to do it was to be more of a U.S. and the world. So this meant that I kept the U.S. at the center, but I tried to make transnational and international connections. But my feet really stayed rooted in the U.S. My intention was to limit the geographic and intellectual scope of the project in order to complete a somewhat manageable book in a timely fashion. But I soon felt limited by these constraints. As I made new discoveries, my questions changed, and so did the geography of the project. Back to the U.S.-Canadian and U.S.-Mexican borderlands, then to the Americas, and then more recently in the world. About 2 years ago, I was close to finishing that book, but again, I was not happy with it. I felt that there was much more to be done. Even though I had moved from U.S. history to borderlands to hemisphere, these land-based boundaries still seemed arbitrary, and I pondered connections that took me across the Atlantic and Pacific Oceans and also expanded the frame temporally and geographically. And so much of this has been based on just fabulous new research that comes out from many of us in the audience every year. So, for example, new research on the so-called coolies or Asian indentured servants, research by Moon-Ho Jung or Kathy Lopez or Lisa Young, demonstrated the importance of the Caribbean in the early 19th century and how Asians were central to the histories of the Black Atlantic world of slavery. So there were over 400,000 South Asians who went to West Indian plantations as coolies between 1838 and 1918, and another 250,000 that went to Chinese that went to Cuba and Peru from 1847 to 74. In Cuba, coolies worked alongside slaves in slave-like conditions. The black-white race relations structuring the economics of labor and definitions of citizenship, national identity, freedom, and personhood laid critical foundations for how Asians would be viewed, treated, included, or excluded in Cuba. These earlier migrations, usually treated as separate and distinct from the larger migrations, global migrations of so-called free Chinese, were in fact directly related to each other. For example, the migration industry that developed in South China for the coolie trade helped facilitate the larger migration of gold rush and later era immigrants from China. I think this is something that Eliot focuses on. Now more rooted in earlier decades and in Latin America, my project took another turn as I started asking, once you start going backwards, it's hard to know when to stop. And I began to ask, when and where does the history of Asians in the Americas begin? Most national histories, of course, begin with those the large mass migrations. So in the U.S., it's the Gold Rush era. In Canada, it's similarly the Gold Rush era. In Cuba and the West Indies, it's the arrival of Asian indentured laborers. But what about earlier? What else might I have missed? I started working backwards, and I was introduced to a South Asian slave girl who arrived in colonial New Spain in the late 17th century. She was owned by a Spanish captain named Miguel de Sosa. She arrived in Acapulco via a Manila galleon from the Philippines. She was christened Mira Catarina de San Juan, and she lived and worked in Captain de Sosa's household in Puebla, Mexico, and became free upon his death. In her later years, she became known as a healer and a Catholic visionary who worked amongst the poor and sick until she died in 1688. Catarina de San Juan remained a highly respected figure in Mexico, especially in her hometown of Puebla. Located on the Camino de China, the Chinese road that ran from Acapulco to Veracruz, Puebla had a large criollo population of American-born Spaniards who stopped to promote the city's importance in Spanish imperial and Christian history. Catarina became a heroine to this emerging class, who revered her as a local saint, even if she had arrived as a foreigner. A Chino from Asia who had become Christian and local. As these two things, she represented two important historical linkages and aspirations at work in New Spain at the time. One was Europe's search for Asia and Christian converts, and two was the successful spiritual conquest of the New World. So she represented both. Revered as a saint, by the way, this is from a hagiography, biography of Mira that was produced as part of the campaign to canonize her, written in very difficult Spanish. Revered as a saint, Mira Catarina de San Juan is also believed to have been the prototype for La China Poblana, the Chinese girl from Puebla town. And let me just remind you, if you do not know already, that the word Chino or China became synonymous or conflated with anybody from Asia. So it did not matter if you were from the Philippines or Japan or South Asia, you were Chino as part of the racial categories in colonial Spain. The Chinese girl from Puebla town, an iconic symbol of Mexican womanhood known for her distinctive dress, hairstyle, and behavior, typically a white blouse with silk and beaded embroidery, a similarly decorated full skirt, and a shawl resembling Indian-style gagaras. Mira Catarina de San Juan's journey from India to New Spain thus reminds us of the long histories that connect Asia to the Americas. This is that world global history scale. She came across a Manila galleon. But she also illustrates how Asians became American, and I say American in quotes, and I mean American this way, not just the U.S., a part of and apart from the Americas at the local, Puebla, and national Mexican scales. This discovery of Mira Catarina de San Juan convinced me that the starting point for a history of Asians in the Americas had to include her and others like her, like the estimated 40 to 100,000 Filipinos, Chinese, Japanese, and others from Southeast Asia and India who crossed the Pacific to the New World on the Manila galleons. These were those large castle-like ships, immense ships that brought silver from Peru and Mexico to China as the first world currency, and then luxury items like porcelain and tea and textiles to the New World. And in fact, the trade was so tremendous that what had started as luxury items really became integrated into everyday products. The use of Chinese-made cloth was worn by everyone from working peasant class up to elites in colonial Spain. If I moved the project back to 1565 with these Manila galleons migrations, I had to rethink when the project would end. Ending in World War II seemed arbitrary, so I revised the project again to continue up to the present. And I examined how the centuries-long migrations of Asians remade the Americas and were shaped by distinct American histories of colonization and expansion, African slavery, nation-building and global relationships, domestic and international politics during world wars, and contemporary globalization. It has 14 chapters, and I thought that was long until I heard that Randy's working on a book with 24, so I feel much better. Some of these stories are similar or are familiar to us. Scholars have long documented the histories of Asian immigration to the United States. A growing body of scholarship now focuses on Asians in Canada and Latin America. They include novels and monographs of Japanese in Brazil and Peru, the Chinese in Panama and Cuba, South Asians in Canada and the West Indies. But so far, much of it has focused on either specific ethnic groups in specific, either local, regional, or national scales, or specific groups within borderlands. And I'm suggesting that we take the scale, the perspective a little bit wider to look at these across comparative as well as national frames. I draw from global history to demonstrate how Asians in the Americas were part of hemispheric American, Asian, and global histories. And this long chronological frame draws on history to better understand the present and vice versa. So some chapters of the book start global and then end up local, like the one that focuses on Mira Caterina de San Juan. And I'm not choosing a particular frame there. I'm just letting it flow and be many things at the same time. Some are diasporic. Trans-Pacific passages brought Asians to specific ports of entry in the Americas, but then they moved north and south, east and west, as the search for employment, land, family, freedom from persecution, pushed them to stay on the move. This is just one of many examples. John Lee Lum was born in 1842 in Sunway County in Guangdong, China. He was struck with gold fever, so he left home for the gold mines of California. He lived and worked there, and then began journeys that took him throughout the Americas. He made his way north. He worked on the Trans-Pacific Railway here in Canada. Then he went south to Brazil, and then to British Guiana, before settling in Trinidad. He found work at the well-known Chinese firm of Kuang Li and Company before starting his own business in 1885. Within 10 years, he became one of the most prominent Chinese businessmen in the island, selling cocoa, general foodstuffs, hardware, liquor, and other imports from Asia. And by the 1900s, he was recognized as the head of the Chinese community in Trinidad. He's been written about as a Trinidadian, but if you just focus on that part of his story, you would lose out on this immense movement across the Pacific and up and down the Americas. Some chapters are distinctly regional that then turn global, like the one in which I cover the Pacific Coast race riots of 1907. In 1907, race riots rippled along the Pacific Coast, starting in May of San Francisco, where the focus was on Japanese, then to Bellingham, Washington, September 4th of 1907, when South Asian laborers, mostly in the lumber mills, were forcibly expelled from that town, and then 3 days later to Vancouver, British Columbia, where a mob of around 10,000 marched through the streets heading to the Chinese and Japanese quarters of that city. Mostly these riots have been written about in local contexts, but if we take a larger frame, it becomes clear that they were the most public, violent, and extreme manifestations of an interconnected anti-Asian racism gripping the Pacific Coast in the early 20th century. Both the causes of the race riots as well as their long-term consequences were part of an intricate web of cross-border and transnational processes, linkages, and alliances. So literally, we can trace the presence and actions of the Asiatic Exclusion League leaders in Bellingham, Washington, to the riots in Vancouver, where there's one guy in particular, A.E. Fowler in Seattle, jumped on a train and went to Vancouver and provided some of the first accounts of what was going on in Bellingham. And the idea was, if they can do it there, we can do it here. And newspaper accounts recount that he climbs up a telegraph pole in Vancouver and is, you know, shouting on the crowd to do their work. By the time that the dust settled from these riots, Japanese migration and to Canada and the U.S. was severely curtailed by two gentlemen's agreements with Japan, finalized within 3 days of each other. Apparently, both the Canadian and U.S. delegations were in Japan at the same time, and the Canadians actually were further along in their discussions than the Americans. But the Americans, this won't be any surprise to you, you know, pulled their weight and had got Japan to sign their agreement first, and Canada followed 3 days later. The Americans and Canadians began to think about the so-called Oriental problem in more than just regional or national terms. Increasingly, they saw it as a global issue, portraying it as a cause that united white men's countries across the Pacific together against a growing yellow peril. Some chapters focus on the borderlands. By the early 20th century, the U.S. had barred almost all immigration from Asia, but Asians did not stop trying to come altogether. The first to be restricted, Asians became the first to enter without documentation or through fraud and deceit on a large scale. The U.S.-Canadian and U.S.-Mexican borders became important sites of both migrant crossings. Some chapters are colonial, North American, and transatlantic. So, for example, I tried to recognize that South Asian migration to the West Indies and Canada was not so much migration to the Americas, but migration within the British Empire. It also represented just one small stream of the 32 million South Asians who left the Indian subcontinent between 1840 and 1940. Canada's membership in the British Commonwealth explains its different policies regarding Asian migration as well, and many of you write on this too. Chinese had taxes instead of U.S.-style exclusion, a continuous journey law barring South Asians instead of a U.S.-Asiatic barred zone. Much more polite. Yet because of their shared land border, U.S. and Canadian policies impacted Asian migration and migrant communities on both sides of the border. Canada, the United States, and Great Britain cooperated with each other on their shared international surveillance of Indian nationalists in North America and in India, a topic that Seema Sohi writes about. When Canada's treatment and regulation of Asian immigrants and Asian Canadians intersected with the United States, we might assess how these connections are part of the triangular Atlanticism, the entangled relations between the U.S., Canada, and Great Britain. So is it Atlantic or is it American? Some chapters are, oh, this is a photograph of the riot damage in Vancouver, a timeline of just how closely related the riots were and the gentlemen's agreements and exclusions of South Asians. Some chapters are hemispheric, like the one that I've provided here for the conference, which focuses on the yellow peril or the threat of Japanese immigration in North and South America during the 1920s and 1930s. With the door closed to North America for Japanese immigrants by the 1920s and 30s, the U.S. Immigration Act of 1924, Canada's restrictions that are put in place, they kind of tightened the loopholes on the gentlemen's agreements by 1928. So North America is closed to Japanese immigrants. And Japanese migration just gets diverted and they go to Latin America. They face intense hostility in both North and South America because of their growing communities, economic success, and ties to an increasingly powerful Japan. Charges that Japanese immigrants were a dangerous yellow peril intent on destroying the Americas from within and without became increasingly common. The campaigns to restrict Japanese immigration in Peru and Brazil were shaped by both internal anxieties as well as influences from the United States. The U.S. is, of course, a growing power within Latin America by this time and really exerting its foreign policy muscle. This is a photograph from Lothrit Stoddard's book, The Rising Tide of Color Against White World Supremacy, published in 1920, and it separates the world into various different lands, the white lands, or the white man's lands, the yellow man's lands, the brown man's lands, etc. And his argument is that until now, each one of these lands had been, the peoples within had been contained. Of course, he doesn't talk about European colonialism, but he says each one of these lands had been contained. But the threat now is that Japan has ambitions and the power and ability to achieve those ambitions, and they are not going to be placated or satisfied by just staying within the yellow man's lands. They're coming for us. They're coming for the white man's lands, and we need to figure out what to do about it. So it's yellow perilous, like Lothrop Stoddard. He is read throughout the world, but there are copies in the Canadian archives of British Columbian politicians' copies of his book, all dog-eared and notations made, and he gets reprinted in South American newspapers. So I talk about this, these transnational or hemispheric discussions about the yellow peril and how they relate to each other, both in local context, but then connected across the Americas. By the 1920s and 1930s, restrictions on Japanese immigration had been put in place in many countries in the Western Hemisphere to defend individual nations against perceived invaders, but also to combat the yellow peril as part of a larger global struggle over race. Connecting both North America and Latin America together, episodes like the Yellow Peril help us push the boundaries of scholarship on the transnational Americas that literary scholar Sandhya Shukla and Latin American historian Heidi Tinsman have proposed. And I think this is particularly helpful for those of us here at this conference. They define the Americas as a, quote, transnational and transregional formation defined against the notion of nation states. Their interdisciplinary Americas paradigm thoroughly connects Latin America with North America, but also leaves open connections to other sites of America, such as Hawaii and the Philippines. Eschewing national histories of separate countries, as well as a north-south dichotomous comparison that has too often characterized America scholarship, which focuses on a developed U.S. and a developing Latin America. Shukla and Tinsman focus on shared histories of connection and interaction between peoples in the Americas. And I'm going to get back to the shared histories of connection, because I think that might help us with these different definitions. There's a growing body of scholarship in Asian American, Asian Canadian, and Asian Latin American history, but we have not yet connected the dots to tell a wider story. And I see this on the ground. I see it in conferences and in books and articles that take the U.S.-Canadian borderlands or the U.S.-Mexico borderlands as their areas of study, but few connect them together. I come to Canadian conferences and wonder what can be gained by looking at Mexico and Latin America. And then I go to Latin American studies conferences and I find I'm the lone voice talking about Canada. I think that we can do better, and I know that this conference is a great start. One central aspect connecting these regional, national, hemispheric, and transnational histories is race, as many of the conference papers here have made clear. So we see this in the parallel and interconnected histories of Chinese restriction in the Americas. I'm not a timeline person, and whenever I teach undergraduate students, I tell them, you're not going to have to memorize that many dates, and we're not going to march through time as part of our studying of history. However, one of the first things I did in doing this project is I made a timeline, because to me, it was the most vivid example of what was almost like a domino effect, or something happening simultaneously, and something that people were not connecting. So simple things help illustrate larger trends. We see this in the parallel connected histories of Chinese restriction. and the parallel connected histories of Japanese incarceration in the Americas. So a poster of Executive Order 9066 in the U.S., a photograph from UBC of the relocation of Japanese Canadians, and from the National Archives, the arrival of Japanese Latin Americans in the United States on U.S. transport ships. So how do we tie this all together? There are more connections to be made. What I've offered is literally just the tip of the iceberg. I began this talk by explaining how I've gradually evolved from a U.S. historian to a tentative world historian. That evolution has convinced me that different global, hemispheric, and national frames are necessary to tell this story. There's no uniform approach or framework that fits all of the patterns that I want to dissect. And I think that that's exactly the point. But the task of connecting these histories together remains challenging. So with each one of these chapters presented here, I began to tell the story from one perspective or one lens. But as that one thread became interwoven with others, it became part of a larger tapestry. The local blended into the national, and then into the global. Viewing them alone within just that one framework limits us and perhaps even blinds us from other larger patterns. U.S. history and transnational history has matured enough in its recent iterations to be able to examine multiple geographic scales simultaneously. We need research that recognizes migrants' overlapping worlds. We know that history takes place on multiple spatial scales, local, regional, national, and global, and no one scale truly captures the complexity and magnitude of the past. So as Richard White explains, each scale reveals some things while masking the others. And one way to address this problem is to write history that, quote, does not have to choose between local, regional, national, and transnational, that can establish shifting relationships between them. Another way to approach history is what I call transnational histories of connection, transnational histories of connection, that help us explore where comparisons and especially connections across time and space can offer productive insights. So sometimes it will be parallel, sometimes it will be change over time, but sometimes there will be tensions and conflicts. Focusing on transnational histories of connection does not mean that the nation and the importance of the nation state itself can be ignored. Many projects affecting immigrants, including immigration regulation, detention, deportation, etc., were nation-based and indeed were integral in the making and consolidation of modern nation states. Crossing and questioning the sanctity of national borders should not erase the inequalities that created those same borders and divisions. So we need to fully consider how local, regional, and national histories emerge from and shape larger transnational processes. Both connections, divergences, and tensions and conflict would be significant. The goal would be to widen the transnational lens beyond just the migrants themselves, or the migrant networks, but to think about how they're embedded in larger politics, economic forces, etc., cultural production. Borderland scholarship has pushed the boundaries of this kind of thinking, but we might also consider other crossroads where people, culture, capital interconnected with each other. In this sense, places like gateways, like the immigration station at Angel Island, is an ideal site that encompasses local, regional, national, and transnational histories. But other crossroads of interaction might include exchanges between Pacific Coast ports like Vancouver, Honolulu, and Sydney, or the Anglo-American web connecting Ottawa, London, and D.C., a Caribbean Gulf Coast route including Havana and New Orleans. Lastly, we would want to connect local, national, and transnational histories across time. In the case of Asians in the Americas, there are many differences between the past and present. The scale of migration is larger and more diverse in our contemporary period. And in the case of North America, the economic status and backgrounds of today's Asian immigrants are largely different from the laborers who came in the early 20th century. Yet there are similarities that help us better understand the past. So, for example, Indian immigrants in North America who were ardent Indian nationalists in the early 20th century have an echo in today's generation of Indian immigrants who invest in their homeland on a massive scale. And NRIs, or non-resident Indians, are the so-called new VIPs. In both cases, Indian identity in North America is shaped concurrently by the experiences of being an ethnic immigrant minority and a transnational Indian identity shaped by intense Indian nationalism. Chinese paper sons who came with fraudulent documents into the United States or were smuggled via circuitous routes and across sea and land during the early 20th century, again, there's a new generation of Chinese who pay tens of thousands of dollars to enter the U.S. across the Mexican desert or in the holds of steamship tankers. The contemporary histories of Asians in the Americas are not just about the present. And one of the most salient features about contemporary communities is the way in which the long history of Asians in the Americas are being used by descendants and new immigrants to push for civil rights and national inclusion, as well as strengthen trans-Pacific and Asian diasporic ties. So, for example, when Japanese Brazilians marked the 100th anniversary of Japanese immigration in 2008, the celebrations affirmed the place of Japanese Brazilians within the Brazilian nation state. It also affirms the enduring strength of Japan-Brazil relations and the benevolence of the Brazilian nation itself. So there was taiko drumming and samba dancing, and the speeches were about that myth of national of uplift through the immigrants. The revitalization of the barrio in Havana, Chinese barrio in Havana, has led to a celebration of Chino-Cubana heritage, as well as new investment from China. And when national governments have offered apologies and reparations for historical injustices, here I'm thinking about the incarcerations of Japanese Americans, Japanese Canadians that took place in 1988, or the official apology by Stephen Harper in 2006 for the Chinese head taxes, and then just recently, this past summer in June, the U.S. government's official statement of regret for the Chinese exclusion laws. These acts of apologies and reparations for historical injustices are used by both Asians in the Americas to call attention to past discriminations, and it allows nations to perform acts of racial progress and reconciliation. So history itself, history and memory, is a strategy, it's a strategic tool to be used or performed in contemporary immigrant communities. So in conclusion, we cannot separate the histories of people on the move, the borders they cross, the communities and families they maintain, and the social, economic, and political networks they inhabit into distinct geographic zones or scales. My advice is to choose the lens, local, community, regional, borderlands, national, transnational, global, whatever works best for the particular project at hand. But be open to mix things up. Expand the geographical focus. Go backwards and forwards chronologically to see precedents, repeats, consequences. Remember that not every chapter has to look the same. Being flexible in our choices, finding the tensions and connections will help us write new immigration histories that illuminate the complicated journeys, experiences, and patterns at all scales. Thank you very much.
You've been listening to a recording of Erica Lee's lecture, Local, National, and Transnational Histories of Immigration to the Americas, given on October 19th, 2012, as part of the Borderlands Workshop at Glendon College in Toronto. You can find recordings of other talks on activehistory.ca.